Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and I'm joined as always by Lahav Harkov. And this week, we are marking the one-year anniversary of the Abraham Accords. And I was thinking, Lahav, I was wondering if you remember how a year ago, I actually got a tip from someone in Washington that a big story was going to be coming out. I think it was on a Thursday late evening, early evening here in Jerusalem. So it was like, you know, the middle of the day on the East Coast in Washington. And someone had told me, you know, there might be something that's going to be happening big in Washington. And the big story at the time, as you recall, was the annexation, right? Netanyahu had announced his intention to annex. The Trump administration had previously, in the rollout of the Peace to Prosperity plan, had given its kind of green light, but then put on a red light for Israeli annexation in the West Bank. But it was always still, was it going to happen? Was it not going to happen? And we were wondering here, what's this big story that might be coming out? And kind of as we were talking among ourselves, it was, you know, maybe it's got to do something with annexation. Maybe it's just going to be the Jordan Valley, or maybe it's going to be settlement blocks, or, you know, something in that realm of what might happen. And then came around 6 p.m., I think it was, Israel time.
Well, we were writing already, like sometimes when we expect something to happen, right? We sort of write in preparation and then we fill in the blanks when it happens so we get the story fast. So I remember that, like, I and Tova Lazaroff, the settlements reporter for the Jerusalem Post, that we were preparing annexation stories.
Right. Because that's what we all thought it would be. No one. And I mentioned this story because I think it's, you know, it's just interesting kind of how a newspaper works a bit behind the scenes. But also, none of us thought that this was what was going to happen. But this is what happened. And that day was the historic announcement by the Trump administration, by President Trump, that Israel was normalizing relations with the United Arab Emirates. Bahrain would follow. The Abraham Accords, as they would later be called, would roll out also with Morocco, later Sudan. But this was a historic process for the state of Israel, and it was a big step, I think, for the region. And this week, right, there were some pretty monumental events that happened, right, just this week alone.
Yeah, I mean, this week, Foreign Minister Lapid was in Morocco. He met with the Moroccan foreign minister, and it was the first time an Israeli foreign minister had visited Morocco since 2003. In 2003, and this is interesting, Sylvain Shalom went and met with the king of Morocco and tried to convince him to go back to normalizing ties with Israel, because in the 90s, after Oslo, Morocco had low-level ties with Israel, and they broke it off in the Second Intifada. It wasn't just Morocco. There were a few other Arab countries. Anyway, that didn't work. But in recent years, Morocco and Israel, much like Israel and the UAE and Bahrain, grew close on security cooperations because Morocco has a lot of problems with Iran. And so, yes, they came in and they joined the Abraham Accords in December. And now we have a foreign minister there, Yair Lapid. And he has a delegation of famous Moroccans with him. Now, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but he brought Welfare Minister Meir Cohen, who was born in Morocco. And he brought singer Shimon Bouskila, who was born in Israel. His parents are from Morocco, and he sings songs in Moroccan, and he's going to perform for the Jewish community in Morocco. So that'll be a fun thing. I guess it will have already happened by the time this podcast comes out.
Important to say, though, that Israelis have been traveling. There's been, back in the pre-COVID days, there were Israeli tour groups that would frequent Morocco, kind of heritage trip, similar to what us Ashkenazi Jews might do in Poland or, you know, Eastern Europe.
My Ashkenazi parents visited Morocco, but I don't think that they've done their own heritage trip in Eastern Europe. Tens of thousands of Israeli Jews go every year. And also Israelis go to Tunisia every year, and Tunisia is not friendly to Israel at all. So it still makes a difference.
Israelis like to go where they can go. By the way, when the announcement was made last year, the first thing that came out, like the autumn, you know, people, yeah, of course, there's Iran and there's the Palestinians and there's regional trade and just the realignment. But what was most your average Israeli, what was he or she focused on? How much are the vacation packages going to cost in Dubai, right? And we've seen since then about 200,000 Israeli tourists have traveled to United Arab Emirates in the last year alone, which is just astounding. It's an incredible honor. I've been there twice. I think, what, you've been there two or three times?
I've been there three times now. I have yet to go to one of the famous resorts. Although I did, when we had the Jerusalem Post conference, I did have time for a little touring. The other times were these, you know, whirlwind trips. People are always like, oh, you get to travel the world as a diplomatic reporter, which I appreciate it and I enjoy it. But you don't really get to see, you know what I mean? You see the foreign ministry and you see your hotel. So I did get one trip where I got to actually see Dubai.
Right. I remember once I accompanied a defense minister, I think this probably was 2005, to Cairo for a meeting with then President Mubarak. And people were like, wow, to go to Cairo. And I said, yeah, all I saw was the presidential palace in Cairo. That was it. Nothing beyond that. But also this week, Lahav, you met with the Bahraini deputy foreign minister who visited Israel. And he made some interesting comments, right, about Iran, about the new relationship with Israel. What was that like?
Yeah. So he's the undersecretary for political affairs. And he holds this sort of portfolio of deepening ties between Bahrain and Israel. And he also is the chairman of like a major think tank in Bahrain. So he came on this trip. And I think that a lot of journalists, I got an exclusive interview with him, but he also did a briefing with a group of journalists. And I could tell from the way they wrote their news stories that they were surprised by how candid he was speaking about Iran. Because usually in these relations between Israel and Arab countries, Iran is the elephant in the room, but nobody is talking about it. It's only being spoken of in secret. And he came out and said, there's nothing to hide here, even though I'm sure there are plenty of things being hidden. But there's nothing to hide here. We said publicly that the head of the Mossad visited Bahrain last year. We cooperate on security. We have a lot of shared challenges. And I thought that that was just surprisingly candid of him, really refreshing. But about Iran specifically, Bahrain faces a lot of challenges. You know, they're an island country. They're an archipelago. And all of these attacks by Iran on ships really hurts them as a maritime trade hub. And they also have upheaval sort of with, maybe upheaval is too strong a word, but they have extremists in their country that they say are sponsored by Iran. They've had different arrests. They've found sort of IED factories and things like that that were paid for basically by Iran and funneled to young Bahraini extremists. So they do have a lot of issues about Iran, and we spoke about that. And our listeners can read more about it on jpost.com.
So these were like just two of the events that took place this week that kind of marked, coincidentally, I guess, or intentionally, the 1 year anniversary to the Abraham Accords. We're also we have an interview later with Avi Berkowitz, who was one of the architects behind the Abraham Accords in the Trump administration. He was the point person for international negotiations within, and an assistant to the president, and really was one of the people who shuttled back and forth between Jerusalem and Abu Dhabi and Rabat and Bahrain and other places to try to bring and normalize these relations. We asked him right in that interview what other countries might be still in line, what could be possible, some within the region, some a little further east. So that's worth listening to on this podcast. But Laha,
you know, I want to say, like, I'm glad we got to interview Avi, because I think he's very modest and deserves a lot of credit that maybe he doesn't get from people. People sort of underestimate him because of his modesty. But he played a really instrumental role. I mean, he was just flying all over the region in those last months of the Trump administration.
For sure. But give us a sense also, though. So how does, you know, we spoke about the 200,000 tourists who went to the UAE. We had a story earlier this week in the Jerusalem Post of, I think it's about $570 million in trade, bilateral trade, and they expect that to grow and to reach the billions in the next few years. But what else are we talking about, right? And how do these relations illustrate themselves?
I mean, first of all, you know, the big thing in the news has been, in the recent months, has been the Iran deal and the Biden administration's negotiations to return to the Iran deal. And the Gulf states, including UAE and Bahrain and Israel, have all been sort of warning the Biden administration of the weaknesses of the deal, that it does not address Iran's aggression throughout the region through proxies, its ballistic missile program, and things like that. And I think that that's, I mean, look, the Biden administration maybe listened, but isn't, doesn't seem to have changed his mind about anything from those talks. But I still think that it's important that there's this sort of united message coming from the region about Iran being a really bad actor. You know, and on top of that, I think that there's just something really deeply symbolic that I think Israel is a country in the Middle East, but has not been allowed to be of the Middle East for, you know, since its establishment, basically because of hostility from the countries all around it. But really, Israel has a lot to share with the region, and has a lot that it can get from the region, you know, through trade, through cultural exchange, through scientific exchanges. You know, there's just all kinds of things that sometimes I'm surprised when I hear sort of the ways these countries want to collaborate with Israel. And of course, I shouldn't be surprised, but, you know, for example, basically all of them want Israel's water technology, like Bahrain and Israel and Mikorot, which is the big water company in Israel. They signed an agreement for, you know, desalination, because we all sort of share similar challenges being in, you know, one of the hot spots of the world, you know, droughts and things like that. So it's really the sky's the limit.
You know, on that note of water, this week came out the UN report that basically warns, included dire warnings over the state of the planet, right? And how if we don't have anything, if nothing's done right now, we are going to be in big trouble. Already by the 2030s, we're going to see temperatures rise and water levels go up. And they called it, I think, a code red for humanity. And you wrote about the diplomatic, or I guess I would say maybe the political opportunity that potentially exists for Israel.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very cynical when we put it that way. But basically, after that report came out from the UN, the foreign ministry released a statement basically supporting the report and saying that, you know, all the countries in the world need to work together to fight global warming. And I was just like, what is this statement? Like, it just doesn't, it's not like a typical statement that you get from the foreign ministry. So I inquired about it, and I learned that actually the foreign ministry has a dedicated ambassador for climate change and sustainability, which I didn't know, but I guess it shouldn't have surprised me, because it is such a huge issue on the international stage. And in Israel, it doesn't get as much attention as say in the US, and certainly not in Europe. You know, I don't know about other places, but when I, you know, the news outlets that I read in English, give it a lot of attention. He said that, you know, the way Israel can really contribute to fighting global warming, and I think the subtext here is that Israel is very small. So, you know, even we should try to cut our carbon emissions, but even if we, you know, really cut it and we're a world leader in it, we're such a small country. But the way that Israel can really contribute to the fight against global warming is, and climate change, is with our technological prowess. You know, and I mentioned water solutions, right? Israel's been using drip irrigation since the 1950s, and a lot of countries around the world sort of bought that technology from Israel back then. Israel is the only country in the world, this I didn't mention in the article, but Israel's the only country in the world that ended the 20th century with more trees than it had at the beginning of the 20th century. And then more recently, Israel's a leader in developing sort of lab-grown including poultry. Yeah. So you have
hamburgers made in a laboratory.
Exactly. So, you know, replacing beef, replacing poultry, and the beef industry, you know, has massive emissions. And then something interesting that I had not known about previously is, you know, we all know what renewable energies are. We know about wind power. We know about solar power. But one of the big problems is, okay, you have a huge solar field in the Negev. What do you do at night? Where do you get your electricity from? So Actually, there are a lot of Israeli companies that are coming up with solutions for energy storage. So turning the solar power into energy and then storing it for later use in order to make it sort of more usable around the clock.
You know, I've always felt after 28 years living in this country that the climate or environment, obviously extremely important. This is the future of our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. But for Israel was never high on the list of priorities because it's basically almost an existential challenge to get through the day in Israel, that to think about what the sea levels of the Mediterranean are going to be in 60 years from now is just way too far off for this country. And by the way, that as huge a problem as that is, and I think Israel has changed with that, right, as society has changed, but we see that lack of strategic thinking often throughout a lot of different spheres of government and society.
Yeah, there's definitely a lack of long-term planning here. I do think this government is starting to take the environmental issues more seriously, though. You know, I could be wrong, but I don't remember Netanyahu ever talking about climate change. And Bennett has talked about it more than once now. You know, the foreign ministry is coming out with this statement. There's the international conference. It's called COP26. That's going to be in Glasgow in November. It hasn't been decided who's going to go, although it is a summit. So in theory, Prime Minister Bennett is the one who's invited. But Israel plans to participate. We don't know who exactly will be there yet.
Interesting. Well, maybe you'll get a trip out of that to Scotland, Lahav, which I can tell you is a...
Yeah.
It was there a long time ago. Beautiful country. Anyhow, we should probably dedicate at some point a podcast to the environment and talk maybe a little more deeper about the Israeli efforts on this. But for this week, we're focused more on the Abraham Accords. So stay tuned for a great, fascinating interview with Avi Berkowitz, the former architect behind the Abraham Accords within the Trump administration. It's our pleasure to have with us today Avi Berkowitz, the former, and I think I'm getting this title right, United States Assistant to the President and Special Representative for International Negotiations, which is quite a mouthful. But he's more, I would say, well known for being one of the architects, or key architects even, of the Abraham Accords, whose one-year anniversary we are marking this week. Avi, it's great to have you with us. And maybe I'll just start off with asking, has it lived up to what your expectation was when embarking on this journey of trying to help normalize relations between Israel and some of its Arab neighbors, Gulf states?
Well, thank you for having me. And yes, I'm really, really proud of the Abraham Accords and the success of our team. And I'll, you know, mention Jared Kushner as well as really an important member. And of course, President Trump, who deserves appreciation as we, you know, reach this 1 year anniversary. For me personally, when I was, you know, working on the negotiations, there was obviously the Israeli-Palestinian component of the negotiations, which I would, I guess, admit that we probably could have done more. That is still an issue. But as it relates to the Israeli-Arab conflict, I think that we've had just tremendous success. Of course, there's still a lot of significant countries that need to normalize relations with Israel, but we were making progress towards those as well. But within a 4 year period, to look back on the achievements that we had as an administration on, you know, Israeli Arab normalization, I think it was a tremendous success, although I am slightly biased.
I have to agree with you, honestly, that it's been, I mean, we've just seen so many things happen in this past year that are unprecedented and that nobody expected to happen in such a short time. So what would you say is sort of the biggest landmark or the most sort of amazing, sort of the biggest achievement?
Yeah, so when we were doing the negotiations, one of the most important elements that I would push for with other countries, that was a necessary element in my mind that, you know, because although we ended up getting full normalization with four of the countries, of course, Sudan is a little bit of a different situation. But the main thing that I was always pushing for was direct flights between the countries, because so long as you have people-to-people interactions, which direct flights directly enables, I think you have the ability to really change the region and change the scenario. And so the fact that over 200,000 Israelis have already visited the United Arab Emirates, when you consider the fact that we've had COVID We've had two changes in leaderships in three of those initial countries that joined onto the Abraham Accords with Israel and the United States, as well as violence between the Israelis and the Palestinians. When you take into account some of the potential setbacks, and yet you look at the amount of people-to-people interactions, I saw actually Jerusalem Post had an article the other day that already trade has topped $570 million annually in this first year. When you look at just the people-to-people interactions, not only on the business, but also on the personal level, that to me is when you win. And if you look at Morocco, I think the fact that flights began recently in the end of July, it was also just a massively significant component. And I'm really excited for Israelis to get to visit these countries.
You mentioned the Palestinian violence that took place. And, you know, we at the Jerusalem Post and you tweeted about it at the time, we held a conference with the Khalij Times, which took place literally, I think it was 2 weeks after the round of violence in May. And I can say now openly that there was concern and there were talks about whether this is the right time, but they stuck with it and we held the conference. What do you think that means, really, like on a deeper level? Is it that, you know, there are some people, let's say, who might think the Arab countries, the Gulf states, they don't care about the Palestinians, but we know that they do care about the Palestinians. So how does that kind of work itself out?
Yeah, the violence, I thought at the time, you know, I noticed a lot of people tried to use the violence as a way to attack, you know, the success of the accord, saying clearly, you know, it hasn't been as meaningful as perhaps, you know, its negotiators claimed or, you know, its champions claimed. And I always thought that, you know, rang a little bit hollow simply because the Abraham Accords does not profess to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It professes to be an important initial step in resolving the Israeli-Arab conflict. And I think sometimes it's important to acknowledge what things do, but also to accept what things do not do. And, you know, the Abraham Accords are historic for the ability to change the region, but there's still going to need to be more work on the Israeli-Palestinian file. And I think that's worth acknowledging. But as it relates to your question, I think I probably went adjacent to it. But I also... I think as it relates to just Israeli-Palestinian violence, at the end of the day, the violence, it flares up every couple of years. It's something that, you know, I think should pain people, observers on all sides. You know, even though we understand Israel's, you know, necessity to defend itself, the fact that this situation it continues to go on and Hamas continues, you know, to unfortunately run the Gaza Strip is something that has just been detrimental to the lives of the Palestinians and it's really an unfortunate situation.
You know, I see the Abraham Accords as like a real sort of common sense policy in the sense of that, like, yes, it was a surprise when it happened, but then it just made so much sense. And it was like, sort of, why didn't this happen earlier? What do you think was sort of the turning point or the points for the Trump administration where you all realized that there's a different approach to peace in the Middle East that could be taken?
Yeah, so when the president unveiled the, you know, his peace plan in January of 2020, I would say that our focus was still very, very significantly, as late as then, on working to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, more so than even working towards the Abraham Accords. I think the plan that the president unveiled, honestly, is still the best plan, and I haven't seen any other plan that has been put forward that, you know, it is better. But at least as it relates to our team in the White House, that was really our initial focus. And it was for the first 3 years, you know, significantly. But when we put out the plan, it was actually really interesting because the Emirates, Bahrain and Oman all sent their ambassadors to the White House for the unveiling of the plan. And I think for a lot of us, that was a turning point. I think there were other turning points along the way, but it certainly was a fourth quarter, you know, for an sports analogy, sort of intuition of ours to begin it. And And that's not to say we weren't pushing towards normalization throughout the administration, but our significant focus up until that point was definitely working on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But slowly but surely, we were pushing forward on this normalization track until we had the breakthrough in really June, July of 2020.
You know, in the fall, winter of 2020, there was a lot of talk that there was going to be even more countries, maybe even Saudi Arabia. Was that really close? Did it seem like there was going to be a fifth Abraham Accords country?
Well, without naming specific countries, yes. And I was personally working with Jared Kushner on, I would say, three countries specifically that we felt that we were close to bringing on board. And I'll just say that close, you know, could still mean a year or so away, as these negotiations are, of course, extremely complex and require a lot of things to go your way, honestly. And so the results of the election, of course, are a relevant factor. And the fact that we were able to get Morocco to come on board post November, I think is really a, you know, just a tribute, I guess, to the team and the hard work, and but also to the Moroccan leadership, because it showed their willingness to really go forward with peace. But we were close with a bunch of additional countries, and you know, prior to leaving, Jared and I met with now current government officials and relayed to them, you know, where we were along the lines. And I'll just say I wish them really the best of luck, because I am no longer in the government, but the job is no longer done, right? It's not yet done. That's probably a better way of saying that. There is still much to be done. And so if it's going to be done, it will require the current administration and future administrations to really, you know, I think buy into our theory, but also, you know, prioritize this, perhaps at the expense of other things that perhaps are being prioritized. And I'm always ready to help if need be.
There were also reports not only about the Saudis and maybe Oman, but also about some countries maybe in a little farther east, like Indonesia. Do you think that there would be movement on those countries? And let me also just add to that, on following up on what you just said, do you, you know, your offer to the administration to be of help, do you feel that the current administration led by President Biden is using the momentum created by the Trump administration with the Abraham Accords to continue to bring more countries into the fold and to expand those relationships?
So as it relates to your first question, eastward looking, though, I could just tell you there were countries in that list you mentioned that I was in negotiations with, as well as Jared Kushner. And just a caveat, sometimes when you're working towards normalization, you do so in a piecemeal fashion. So some of these countries, you know, there's certain visa restrictions that make it very difficult for Israelis to travel there directly. I consider that to be of massive import and yet of minor change on their behalf to get it done. So I was focused very significantly on that, hoping to eventually lead towards normalization. So I'll say some of the countries I was working towards, it was full on normalization, Abraham Accords, signatories, things of that variety. Other, it was more of a piecemeal, step-by-step approach. As it relates to the Biden administration, the way I feel about this is the way I wish other people would have felt about it when we were in government is, I am not currently in government. I don't fully know what they are working on. I don't have the full insight into the steps that they've taken. And so I don't want to be critical for the sake of being critical. I think the Accords, what makes them so unique and so special is that it retains bipartisan support. And so instead, I'll just thank the Biden administration for working to ensure that the countries that I know of that are currently signatories have stayed on as signatories and are working, you know, very closely with Israel in very positive ways. And so for that, I'm very appreciative. And as it relates to taking the momentum forward, I can only tell you that these things are extremely complicated. And so if it were taking this amount of time, you know, I wish them really luck, and I'm always happy to be a voice to help in any way I can.
When these agreements were being signed, there was some criticism in Israel that it was sort of like an arms deal that Israel was part of the arms deal, quote unquote, that the UAE wanted F-35s and it was doing this just to get the F-35s. You know, Sudan wanted sanctions relief to be taken off the state and sponsors of terror lists. Morocco wanted, you know, recognition of Western Sahara, and that they were all just sort of like using Israel as a way to get things from America. What do you respond to that criticism? And do you think these things could have happened without these sort of added sweeteners from the U.S.?
So, you know, I think it's important. It's a very fair question. I think it's important to first recognize that I don't think that would make sense to be a criticism of Israel, because whatever the United States was going to do, we were going to do. I don't think somebody could have pushed President Trump to do one thing or not do something. All of those decisions required, you know, U.S. approval. And so I would say, you know, so I would almost remove Israel from the equation. I think if we are to do that, the question would be, are, you know, some of the things that you mentioned necessary components of the deals? The answer is yes and no. Certainly as it relates to Morocco and Sudan, I think that with the UAE, it's a little bit more complicated in that. What we've, you know, spoken about for quite some time now is that was something that they were trying to receive. And of course, the calculation as it relates to Israel's security could never have made it work if not for the normalization. So I see it slightly differently. But yes, those things are extremely important components. They're complicated deals, negotiations where, you know, each country is required to do something, perhaps Israel, honestly, less than anyone, which I think is a tribute to President Trump for not putting Israel in a difficult position to make peace with its neighbors.
Maybe it's a tribute to Israel that wants peace.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's true, but you could at least, you know, be a little bit cynical and say, well, of course they want something to make peace, right? But yes, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu and Benny Gantz and Gabi Ashkenazi, you know, they were great partners, and I'm very much appreciative to them. And I think the whole Israel should appreciate them. And I'll just take a moment to thank Prime Minister Bennett and Foreign Minister Lapid, who have, you know, now picked up the ball. And, you know, Foreign Minister has already been to the United Arab Emirates, to the consulate, to the embassy, you know, in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, respectively. And I'm told that, you know, he's in Morocco on the 12th or on the 11th. So, you know, the fact that they have picked this up and with the same, I think, you know, real excitement that the prior leadership did is really impressive. And I hope to see them continue, you know, in the days ahead.
The vision, though, right, was not only the peace with these Arab Gulf countries, but also included the peace to prosperity plan or the, you know, the some sort of advance and progress with the Palestinians, which, as you mentioned, you know, that was a significant milestone when ambassadors from these countries actually came to the White House for the rollout of that plan by President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu at the time. But there was the Palestinians never came to the table, right? Can you tell us if at all there was this plan has the ability to survive, can still be advanced? Do you think the administration might want to build off that, the current administration?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think plans on this Israeli-Palestinian, you know, conflict, what they usually do is they become a version of a benchmark where, you know, if a side likes a plan more than the other, they refer to it as a starting point, or they try to use it in the negotiations. I would imagine at minimum, the vision for peace and the peace to prosperity components of the Trump administration's plan would at least be that. But what is also possible is if people, and I think Israel is obviously an extremely important component in this, you know, next thing that I'll mention, is that if leadership in Israel really does buy into this plan and really does believe that it has the ability to actually ultimately resolve the conflict, what you might find in time is that their actions look very familiar when you analyze it. And, you know, if you step back, you zoom out and right. You analyze in the greater scope of the plan, and you see, well, actually, they're leaving the possibility for the plan alive through some of their behavior, right? And that, I think, is actually why this one-year anniversary, and I know I'm sort of mixing topics here a little bit, but that's why I actually think it's so interesting, in that I think the Abraham Accords is a similar idea, in that, you know, when we made the initial agreements, we were looking for peace between Israel and those actual four countries who signed on as signatories. And I'll just remind everybody, it's the UAE, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. But what I am certain of, although I don't necessarily know exactly yet how, is that there are people in Africa, there are people in the Middle East that get their media through ways that the same way that people in Morocco get news, and the same way that people in the United Arab Emirates get news. And they have seen the $570 million number between Israel and the UAE. They've seen the tourism boom. They've seen the security agreements. They've seen the opening of consulates to fanfare, both in the United States and in the Middle East. And they've seen the people-to-people rugby matches, the soccer matches, the ways in which the people have grown to get to know one another and do business with each other. And I am sure that it is having an impact on the daily lives of your average, you know, Arab League country that is not yet a signatory to the Accords. And so it's my sincere hope that in time, those statistics will be more understandable. But I am willing to, you know, predict at this very moment that it is going on in mass, and in time, countries that we might not have even thought of as potentially viable for joining the Accords will do so.
One last personal question. You came into the White House about 4.5 years ago, not well known, turned into a prominent player within the whole foreign policy apparatus, and definitely in the Abraham Accords. I'm sure a lot of people would be interested to know who or what Avi Berkowitz is doing today, basically 8 months out of the administration.
Well, I very much appreciate the compliment. You know, 4 years of working in government is taxing. So I definitely took some time to really think about the last few years. But I do hope to always remain close to the Accords, to you know, Jared and I. We're working on the Abraham Accords Institute for Peace to advance the people-to-people connections, trade amongst the countries. Robert Greenway, a member of our team, is actually the executive director and is doing a great job. So I hope to stay close to the people of Israel, the people of the Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, in the coming years as we work to make peace and advance the Accords.
We're very happy that you came on to talk to us to mark a year of the Abraham Accords. So thank you so much, Avi.
Thank you. And thank you guys for giving it attention. And thanks for everybody who's helped to advance the Accords.
Welcome, everyone, to our favorite segment, the Tweet of the Week. This week's tweet comes from Foreign Ministry Director General Alon Ushbiz. His tweet says, "It is a great pleasure going diving with a friend. Bahrain Undersecretary for Political Affairs, His Excellency Sheikh Abdullah bin Ahmed Al Khalifa. We took advantage of the rare chance for underwater diplomatic etiquette." And then a second tweet threaded to that one says, "One knows it is a true friendship when your partner in peace is your diving buddy." And it has these great pictures of Ushbiz and Al Khalifa, who's again an undersecretary in the Bahraini Foreign Ministry, going diving at Rosh HaNikra, which is right by the border with Lebanon, and waving the Israeli and Bahraini flags over the water. And then he has a video of them underground and waving the flags under the water. So I thought that was a very unique way for a visiting diplomat to spend his time and, you know, to show the peace between the two countries, peace underwater.
Not just unique, but also cool, I think, right? That's not your typical diplomatic venue, is a is an underwater scuba diving.
Exactly.
But definitely shows the creativity. And it shows, by the way, kind of what we were talking about earlier of how peace is really, it's not just about government to government, it's also people to people. And this is how you develop those relations, right? Is you don't just sit across a boardroom table, but you go scuba diving together. So I actually thought, I remember that was a cute tweet, and we also wrote a story to go with it, because we thought it was unique. It was not something that you see every once in a while, right? You're mostly, when we think about the foreign ministry, they're not doing stuff like that. Or is that changing maybe under Lapid as foreign minister?
Well, you know, I think that basically every embassy and the consulates, they have like cultural attachés, and they do try to bring Israeli culture to other countries. So I wouldn't rush to call them, you know, stuffy and boring. I think there's a lot of interesting, you know, Israeli film festivals, art, food that happen all over the world. And one of my favorites was that years ago, the embassy in Japan produced an anime video, a Japanese animation about like two Japanese sisters who come visit Israel. And they have a mascot, which is like a cute peace dove that has a Star of David on its stomach. So they like all of the like what's called kawaii, which is like the cuteness culture of Japan. They leaned very heavily into that. So the foreign ministry can be very creative sometimes.
That does sound interesting. Okay. Thanks for that tweet, Laha.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We'll be here next week.